Disrespect will take you places you can't get to from here. Disrespect entertains with a look at the challenges and sometimes the successes of people with disabilities who have taken from them or are denied the full choice of possibilities to affect for the better their own lives or the lives of those above them.
Welcome to another ABC Radio National podcast. For more information, go to abc.net.au/rn.
Hello, I'm Norman Swan, and you're listening to The Health Report. In this program, a special feature on movement and how to make it work better. And I'm talking about your muscles, not your bowels. Better ways of getting better after a stroke, and how to reverse aging in your muscles. Hoover out the old ones, refresh them so they look just like new, and you can do it without drugs. And if you are into drugs, evidence for a performance-enhancing substance that might get you off your mark faster, whether you're off to Beijing or not. The person doing a lot of this work is Mark Tarnopolsky, who's Professor of Pediatrics and Medicine at McMaster University in Canada. A children's doctor looking after older people? How come?
That's an interesting question. I actually trained initially as an adult physician, and my main area of specialty are mitochondrial disorders. But we now know that many of the mitochondrial disorders are present in young children. So
mitochondria, these are the energy-producing bits of the cell that sit in the soup of the cell and right. Have their own genetic structure.
That's correct. So the mitochondria are very analogous to a furnace. So in the way in which we burn natural gas and oxygen to create energy, the mitochondria are present in essentially every cell in our body and mix the food that we eat with the oxygen we breathe and create energy.
And some people think that they're at the heart of the aging process.
Yes, that's a long-held thought, that the mitochondria are essential to aging, and mitochondrial dysfunction or accumulated damage to the mitochondria is a component of the aging process.
The theory is that side products of making energy from food, called free radicals, are needed to send messages inside cells. But when there are too many free radicals, they cause damage to the mitochondria, damage that has a flow-on effect to the body, which we call aging. And since aging muscles are what often debilitates people the most as the years pass, it's important to understand what's going on in mitochondria, because as you'll hear, they're unlocking very practical ways of rejuvenating ourselves. And a lot of this has been learned from rare diseases of mitochondria and muscles. Mark Tarnopolsky again.
It's estimated now that about 1 in 6,000 people have a mitochondrial disease. In children, they present usually with failure to thrive, developmental delay, seizures, or sometimes cardiac hypertrophy where the heart gets enlarged and they have failure to pump. In adults, the most common ones that we see are related to a seizure thing called Milas syndrome, where people have stroke-like episodes, visual loss, hearing loss, droopy eyelids, and muscle weakness are all things that we see in adults who have these mitochondrial disorders.
You believe that by looking at elderly people, you can also learn about what's going on with mitochondria, not that they have necessarily a mitochondrial illness.
Right. With aging, every human being in the world has a mitochondrial disease. All of us have mitochondria. They're all getting older and accumulating mutations. And what we found is some of the hallmarks that we look for in children and young adults with mitochondrial disease are interestingly present not only in our children with disease, but also in the aging process. So in an older muscle, we find many of the same muscle characteristics that we see in children with disease.
To test this idea, a group of researchers did a fascinating study in mice. The scientists disabled genes in the mice in a way which damaged the ability of their mitochondria to repair themselves. The result was old mice.
So what they found then in the mice is they developed graying of their hair, atrophy of the testicles and sex organs in females, kyphoscoliosis, which is very commonly seen with osteoporosis, where they get the Dower's hump, thinning of the muscles, which is really one of the most important healthcare concerns with aging, is that if you get very thin muscle, sometimes called sarcopenia, that can lead to inability to get out of a chair, to care for yourself, and eventually institutionalization because of the sarcopenia process. And so they could recapitulate that by damaging the mitochondrial DNA, showing that mitochondria do have a role in aging.
And you've been on a mission to see whether you can resuscitate the mitochondria.
About 12 years ago, people stumbled onto a serendipitous observation. When they did muscle biopsies from patients who developed sporadic mitochondrial disease. So what happened is one of my colleagues simultaneously in Montreal and also in England did is when they did a muscle biopsy and they took the biopsy and put it in culture, what happens is that all the mature muscle fibers die and then there's a stem cell precursor called a satellite cell, which represents about 2 to 4% of the muscle nuclei that are present. They start to grow and form a myoblast. So what these two...
So this is the process of producing new muscle.
Correct. So what the two folks were hoping for is that they could then use this cell culture technique to study the biology of mitochondrial disease. But to their surprise, what they found is that when they grew up the new muscle fibers, they were completely normal. So in the mature muscle, when they did a muscle biopsy, there were deletions of the mitochondrial DNA, there was dysfunction, there was decrease in enzyme activity.
So they rebooted the muscle in a sense.
Exactly.
Inadvertently, these researchers had renewed the muscle and purged it of the prematurely stuffed mitochondria. Somehow these satellite cells, the ones which were a bit like muscle stem cells, had remained aloof from the aging process, and when given their head, so to speak, regenerated normal muscle containing young mitochondria. And what seemed to have made this happen was the stress and injury caused by the muscle biopsy in the laboratory testing. Mark Tarnopolsky.
So when I heard this, I was immediately interested in exercise as a more acceptable way of damaging the muscle and one that older adults may take advantage of. So we've done some experiments which we can talk about.
In other words, in some way, by damaging the muscle, you revive the mitochondria.
Correct. So what we've done is we've actually done muscle biopsies from young people and old people, and we look in the mature muscle and the satellite cells. In the mature muscle, what we find is with aging, there is a reduction in mitochondrial enzyme activity. There's an increase in damage to the mitochondrial DNA. So we see things called deletions. We see an increase in oxidative stress. And when we do the myoblast cultures from the satellite cells, we see none of this. So the older adult satellite cell seems to have a very young phenotype, and it has no deletions, no damage. So our theory was that if we exercise people...
They had the raw material to be able to produce decent muscle.
Exactly. And we could bring in the good mitochondria, remove the old mitochondria because of the damage of exercise, and in a sense shift down the bad mitochondria or shift them out and get...
So what did you do?
So we trained older adults for 6 months, twice a week for an hour.
What sort of training?
It was weight training, because with weight training, you tend to get more damage to the muscle. And the key here, what we feel, is that you actually have to activate the satellite cells to get the benefit.
So of course, this is what muscle builders and people who want to buff their body have known for years, is that you've actually got to go over the hill to actually tear muscle fibers in order to build muscle.
Essentially, that's true. I mean, you may not have to cause frank damage. It may just be a high degree of strain. But we do know that if you do, for example, marathon running, you're lean and you don't get muscle hypertrophy. The only way to get hypertrophy is to do a fairly high percentage of your maximum and doing few repetitions. For example, what we would say is the one repetition maximum is your maximal. If you drop that to 70% and you do that 10 or 15 times with three sets, that would be a typical set, which would induce muscle hypertrophy.
Now, if you're not a gym junkie, you probably haven't a clue what Mark's talking about. The idea is that you find out the maximum weight you can manage for one single movement. It's called a repetition. So if it's your biceps, it'd be lifting the weight with your hand towards you. Once you know what your maximal weight is, you then drop down to about two-thirds of that weight or less for your actual training. The training usually involves three rounds of 10 or so repetitions of that exercise. So if you can manage 5 kilos just once, you'd probably start training on 2 or 3 kilogram weights, then work up.
So we set out to do that in old people, and we showed, as folks have known since the 70s, that there's an increase in strength and function in the older adults.
And work in Tufts and Boston showed that in extreme elderly in nursing homes.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I mean, even folks into their 80s and 90s. And what we found is that after the 6 months of training, there actually is an increase in mitochondrial enzyme activity, which doesn't happen in young people. These people were fairly active, walking their dog, playing tennis, and doing recreational activity. Clearly, the weight training was more than what they normally did, but it was no different than what activity our younger people had been doing when we've done weight training. And yet, with young people, we never see an increase in mitochondrial activity. But if you think about it, they have healthy, mature muscle fibers with normal mitochondria. So when you do weight training, you just get a shifting of good to good. What's cool about the older adults is that you've got
the garbage disposal.
Right. So there's a process called autophagy, which removes the old damaged mitochondria. The new ones come in from these relatively quiescent satellite cells, and bang, we get an increase in mitochondrial function.
Was this progressive training? In other words, you kept on building them up. Once they got good at one weight, you moved them on to the next, so it was hard work?
There are people who believe that it's impossible to weight train older adults, and I've actually been challenged at conferences saying that you can't weight train older adults because they'll cause damage. I think that's complete bollocks. So what we did, and I do agree that you have to start a little lower. So we started at 50% of their one repetition maximum and then build up to 65 and eventually closer to 70%. Whereas with younger people, we can usually start at 60 or 65% and go up to 80 or 85%. And it's probably more of a joint issue with the older adults that you start to get tendonitis and various joint problems.
And did you find that they got over the hump? In other words, in theory, if you've got the garbage disposal unit working, you're clearing out all the old crap, basically, and you've got this new muscle, did all of a sudden they jump over the fence and it became easier?
Anyone who does exercise notices that it becomes easier. And a lot of these were anecdotes. I mean, we do all of our biochemical and more objective outcomes. But we had some very interesting anecdotes where people were coming in saying they couldn't pick up their grandson or their granddaughter. And after the weight training, they could do that. They could carry all of their shopping bags in instead of making 3 and 4 trips. They could go up and down stairs more easily. There's no question that the weight training in older adults does really improve function. And ultimately, that's what we care about from a healthcare perspective. Can we decrease disability, keep people independent in their homes, and prevent them from having to go and require assistive devices and alternative health care?
Tell me about the creatine study, which is one of these controversial but legal performance-enhancing drugs.
The main controversy behind creatine is the controversy that surrounds all ergogenic aids.
And by ergogenic, you mean the ability to produce more energy?
Yeah, ergogenic work enhancing is really technically what ergogenic means. Now, there are legal and illegal forms of ergogenic substances. For example, exercise could be considered ergogenic. Carbohydrate loading, taking in extra carbohydrates, is an ergogenic process. Caffeine, that's where you start to blur the, you know, doping versus ergogenic aid, because caffeine can be processed as a chemical, but it can also be part of a food substance. And therefore, the IOC had a big problem with caffeine because, you know, how do you tell someone they can't have their morning espresso when that still could give them 100 or 150 milligrams of caffeine and start to raise the level? And people have clearly shown, actually, Louise Burke in Australia has done some beautiful work showing that even fairly low doses of caffeine can be ergogenic or enhance performance at doses which could be found in one cup of coffee. So the IOC previously had a ban on it, and now they don't. Creatine, you could also get, and you could clearly creatine load if you ate about 1.1 kilo of meat every day. And that's not crazy for a top sport power lifter or sprinter to eat that much meat.
So what is it? A raw material for muscle or what?
Creatine is actually synthesized in our liver, kidneys as well, and a little bit in the pancreas every day. So about a gram to a gram and a half of creatine is made every single day by the normal human body process. Creatine is also found in meat and fish, especially cold water fish. It has very high concentration of creatine, as well as omega-3s and other good things. And we get about a gram to a gram and a half of creatine in a typical North American diet. So together, that's about 2.5 to 3 grams of creatine that our muscles, brain, and heart are seeing every day. Almost every tissue in the body contains creatine and is transported from the blood into the tissues with a transporter. And in muscle, it was traditionally thought that what creatine did predominantly was to make phosphocreatine, which is a buffer of energy. So when you start running up a flight of stairs and ATP is broken down,
that's one of the energy substances in the body.
Correct. That's the energy currency of the body. So when ATP gets broken down and you form ADP, you have to reform ATP. So if one was doing a 100...
It's like your lithium battery.
Precisely, but it's got a short half-life. It'll only last for about 8 to 9 seconds. So that gives people that buffer for the first sort of 8 to 9 seconds. As a consequence, people were very interested from the sporting arena to try and improve performance in sprinting. So people that are doing a 100-meter sprint, which, you know, is taking 9.5 to 10 seconds, is creatine going to improve performance? And although it's never been proven with a 100-meter sprint, It was estimated, I believe, at the 1988 Olympics that everyone on the starting line for the final of the 100 meters was creatine loaded. And in the laboratory, if you give young healthy people creatine, it improves performance in repetitive sprint activity by about 1 to 1.4%. But if you think about first to eighth in a 100-meter sprint, it's far less than 1% of the time. So many athletes were taking it as an ergogenic aid in power and sprinting type of activity. Just because of my area of research, I'm obviously less interested in that aspect, but we immediately said, well, this is an interesting compound for the athletes, but I wonder if it would help our patients. So the first thing that we did is we did muscle biopsies from people with different types of neurologic disease, and we found that people with muscular dystrophy and mitochondrial diseases had low creatine in their muscle. So we thought that if the creatine's low, it probably would make sense at least to bring them up to a normal level, and could that creatine deficiency actually cause problems? We've now found that there are creatine deficiency syndromes. So they're genetic diseases where people can't transport creatine into muscle and brain. And these are very serious. Children have seizures, developmental delay. So it clearly shows that creatine is important for brain and also for muscle, and deficiency is not well tolerated.
But in some of those situations, supplementation wouldn't help if you can't get the creatine inside.
Correct. So there's two types. One is the synthesis defect, where creatine supplementation is quite helpful. One is the transport defect, where people are looking at trying to get around the mutant transporter by giving inordinately high levels of creatine without, I hasten to add, much success. But in the case of aging, muscular dystrophy, and mitochondrial disease, you have a muscle that's having a little bit more difficulty bringing creatine in, but still it can transport creatine. So we did a study with Duchenne muscular dystrophy boys where we gave them creatine for 4 months or placebo. As we were doing it, a group in Belgium published a smaller study showing quite substantial benefits, some so remarkable I almost didn't believe them. But when we published our data and analyzed it, we did find an increase in strength, an increase in muscle mass, and some markers of function actually were better when the boys were on creatine. Subsequently, a thing called a Cochrane review, which is a meta-analysis, looked at creatine in muscle disease because there was another big study done in Germany. And the net result was an improvement in function in muscular dystrophy.
Which is remarkable, since there's not much else that helps these kids who are really on a downward spiral.
Well, the interesting thing with Duchenne dystrophy is the only drug available is prednisone or deflazacort. These are corticosteroids, which have inordinate side effects, just unbelievable. I mean, I had a child in yesterday who developed severe diabetes, and we had to pull him off of it after being on prednisone for just a couple of months. Cataracts, osteoporosis, the list goes on. And the improvement in strength is only about 4 to 6%. And yet, over a long period of time, that keeps a boy out of a wheelchair by around about 2 years. Whereas with creatine, we were finding a 9 to 11% increase in strength. And we were seeing this in boys who were on steroids and boys who weren't. So one, it's a nice alternative for those who can't tolerate the steroid side effects. And two, even those on steroids gives them an extra boost.
And you've tried it in the elderly?
We've tried it in the elderly, and just one thing to follow up on that is we also tried it in rats to see if some of the side effects of steroids could be prevented. Because in most of our patients with acquired neuromuscular disease, we use steroids as a treatment, and as you know, it's used for asthma and various other things. And people get muscle weakness and bone loss. And what we found in growing rats, if we treated them simultaneously with creatine, we could prevent many of the bone-related side effects. We could allow them to grow normally instead of having the stunted growth, and we showed improvements in their muscle mass. So there may be other benefits to boys and others on steroids by taking the creatine in terms of preventing side effects. And that's been borne out in a clinical study with polymyositis and dermatomyositis, which are inflammatory muscle diseases. And those folks did show improvement in function when they took the creatine, all of whom were on steroids.
And your trial in the elderly?
We've done two trials. One was published in 2003, where we had older adult men and women train for 4 months, 3 times a week, lifting weights. And what we found is that everybody improved strength, everybody improved muscle mass, and everybody improved function. But the strength increases and the fat-free mass, which is essentially your muscle mass, improvements were greater for those who trained with creatine. And this was a fairly low dose. It was only 5 grams per day, which, you know, is not a lot more than what our muscles are seeing every day just from our normal diet. And we did prove as well with muscle biopsies that we could increase the creatine level in older adult muscle, and it did stay elevated for that time. More recently, we've come back and we've done more molecular work, which we haven't published all of it yet, where we trained people for 6 months, twice a week for an hour, and we found the same thing. Essentially, you could complete more repetitions with creatine. There was greater muscle mass gain, almost 2 kilograms more in those that trained with creatine, and strength was also up as well.
And maintained off creatine?
Yeah, we haven't published all that data yet, so I can't talk too much about it. But if I had to put a hierarchy, I'd say weight training is by far and away, and endurance exercise, I hasten to add, although we didn't do this study, but others have. Weight training, endurance training, number one. Creatine with that is a distant second, but you know, when every little bit helps, it's a reasonable adjunct. Creatine on its own in a healthy older adult may have some beneficial effects, which we could get into, but it's probably not nearly as effective as used in combination with physical activity.
And side effects?
We very carefully check for side effects and screen a number of different tissues. For example, liver function tests, kidney function. We measure what's called creatinine clearance, and we found no side effects on any of the blood markers, and many, many other studies have been published showing that as well. The main side effect that we see are stomach cramps, and no question, reproducibly in Duchenne dystrophy, in my patients in the clinic, in our mitochondrial disease trials, and in older adults and younger adults, about 5% of the people will get stomach cramps, sometimes diarrhea and tummy upset. Usually better if they drop the dose by 50%.
Is there any difference between men and women in your studies, the elderly men and elderly women?
We haven't found any difference with respect to strength gain or muscle mass gain in the older adults doing weight training. Part of that may be due to the fact that they're all postmenopausal and nobody takes hormone replacement therapy anymore. And we think that estrogen is probably a very important factor in what we've seen in young people, that estrogen is involved in differentiating the fuel use that someone uses during endurance exercise.
What happens?
People have known for at least 30 years that if you take a male rat and run it on the treadmill, with and without estrogen, those that are treated with estrogen can run further. They tend to utilize more fat and less carbohydrate. So we were intrigued by that work, which was predominantly by a fellow named Kendrick, Zebulon Kendrick, and we wondered if that was the case with humans. So we very carefully matched young men and young women based on their dietary intake, their training history, and put them on a treadmill and bikes, and we've done this at least 15 studies now. And almost without exception, women exposed to the exact same physical stress will oxidize more lipid, less carbohydrate, and less protein, very similar to what the animal studies have shown.
Oxidizing lipid has a bad connotation because that's the process that leads to atherosclerosis in side arteries. What are you talking about?
You're talking about oxidized LDL. What I'm talking about is oxidation or utilization of the lipid.
So it's a burn.
It's burning. And in fact, elevated levels of the ability to oxidize lipid is advantageous metabolically.
In what way?
You're removing some of the lipid, and well, let me take a step back. We now know that there is a link between excessive lipid accumulation in muscle and liver. You've probably heard of the fatty liver syndrome associated with metabolic dysfunction and the propensity towards the development of type 2 diabetes. So if you can oxidize that lipid and remove it instead of allowing it to accumulate and build up these various toxic byproducts, which in turn inhibit insulin signaling, you're in a more metabolically favorable cellular environment because you're removing the bad lipids.
So what happens in men?
Well, there's no question that any person who exercises, there's an increase in fat oxidation with duration. So the longer you go, you reproducibly will see that we all start to oxidize more carbohydrate. And then the longer we go, the more we start to oxidize lipid. Number two, a highly trained endurance athlete will oxidize more lipid. And that's why we really carefully have to control for training history. Because if we have men who are better trained than the women, then they're going to be oxidizing more lipid and we won't see this sex effect.
So the fitter you are, the more benefit you gain because you've changed the way you metabolize energy.
No question. That's a very reproducible finding, is that the top sport athlete has an enhanced ability to oxidize lipid for any given exercise output. And also, the longer you go, the better. You know, if you're out for 2 hours, at the end of that 2 hours, much more of the energy you're using is coming from lipid versus carbohydrates.
Mark Tarnopolsky is Professor of Pediatrics and Medicine at McMaster University in Hamilton, Ontario. On ABC Radio National. I'm Norman Swan and this has been the Health Report. I'll see you next time.
You've been listening to another ABC Radio National podcast. ABC Radio National, on air and online, with many of our programs available as podcasts or MP3 downloads. All the details at abc.net.au/rn/podcast.
If you don't consider disability the last word on who you are or how healthy you want to be, can't get enough of Australian Dr. Norman Swan. Now with Saturday, September the 5th, Labor Day weekend, coming up, International Bacon Day. We thought you could use these tips to compensate for some of the damage. Now a break. The Hardline Blues Band with T-Line. For Disrespect's review of the news the last week in respect of International Bacon Day on Friday, September 5th, Labor Day weekend. We remind you these are excerpts from articles, and the full articles are in the journals that we refer to and under the author's names that we give you in the reading. In keeping with the fitness note of our program today, author dishes out advice on eating well. From the Spectator, Los Angeles Times, Washington Post News Service, Bob Casper. Michael Pollan's advice on healthful eating is refreshingly straightforward. Eat food, not too much, mostly plants. Pollan, who has written tomes on food, has deliberately kept his latest book in defense of food, An Eater's Manifesto, by Penguin, 1850, short and simple. I was able to cut through the underbrush and discover that those seven words say it all. That was a little alarming to my publisher because she was expecting 50,000 or 60,000 words. But it really did come down to eating real food. Woody and erudite, Pollan is able to discuss the big issues of food and the environment in an approachable, lively style. But the concept took off after Pollan endorsed it during an appearance on the Oprah Winfrey Show. Pollan's rules? Here's a sampling of author Michael Pollan's rules for eating well. Avoid foods containing ingredients that are unfamiliar, unpronounceable, more than five in number, or that include high fructose corn syrup. Shop in the periphery of the supermarket where the fresh fruit is. Avoid the middle where processed food is. Eat plants, especially leaves. Don't get your fuel from the same place your car gets gas. Eat slowly at a table and try not to eat alone. While Pollen's family has adopted Meatless Monday, on days other than Monday, Pollen eats meat, but only from animals that have been raised in pastures, not in feedlots. Once you've seen those places, he said, referring to the industrial cattle operations he visited while researching a magazine story on how a calf comes to market. Once you've seen those places, you lose your appetite. This is The Post. Review by Catherine Monet. Harrison Ford steers clear of the maudlin. Why can't they make good movies anymore? It's actually a pretty good question, and one that producers such as Michael Schamburg and Stacey Scher have spent their entire professional lives trying to make moot. Yet for all the success under the Scher belt, Schamburg and Scher found themselves facing a sheer cliff when it came to funding and developing their newest project. Still untitled, the new movie is being referred to as Crowley, after John and Eileen Crowley, a husband and wife who sacrificed just about everything in an attempt to heal their children from Pompe disease, a life-threatening illness that is considered so rare, it's of little interest to big pharmaceutical companies because there's no money to be made from just a little bit of suffering. Scher and Schamburg thought long and hard about who to bring in to call the shots, and they went with young British director Tom Vaughan. The Brits have a way of making sure things don't get too saccharine, Scher says, and this script needed a delicate touch. It also has an inspirational edge because John Crowley, played in the movie by Brendan Fraser, dedicated his life to finding a cure and miraculously succeeded in wrangling an entire team of medical professionals to develop an enzymatic assistant that could help his children. In the movie, the team of pros is embodied by Harrison Ford, the veteran actor who decided to team with Scher and Schamburg even before Crowley's pages were packed into a FedEx envelope. I think it's a compelling story, Ford says. It's about a young family struggling for the survival of their children, says Ford, arching his eyebrows for emphasis. That's pretty dramatic. Scher and Schamburg never actually articulate the problem, but it's obvious Crowley is a disease movie. Aaron Brockovich wasn't an easy pitch either, Schamburg says. It wasn't easy to explain to people, but in the execution it came together and people got excited. The key is finding a balance between the bleak and the inspirational elements and coming up with an approach that doesn't sacrifice fun and humor on the altar of sick kid earnestness. The movie is slated for release in 2010. Autistic boy kicked off bus, father says. By Oliver Moore in Halifax, the Globe and Mail. A bus driver in Halifax was fully within his rights to refuse to continue along his route with a screaming autistic child as a passenger, a spokeswoman for the transit service said, denying reports that the boy had been thrown off the bus. Sharply different accounts of the incident emerged in 24 hours after a dozen autistic children boarded the bus after a visit to a local science center. The boy's father, David Croft, said that the whole group of children ended up at the side of the road. The driver's primary concern is safe handling of a big vehicle on a busy downtown street, said a spokeswoman for the transit service. The children were on a day trip excursion with Autism Society Nova Scotia, wearing shirts that clearly defined them as autistic. Only minutes into the bus ride, 8-year-old Isaac Croft began screaming. Isaac's screaming can be an unpleasant experience, I freely admit that, Mr. Croft said from his home in Dartmouth. He said this can happen when the boy suffers sensory overload and with no other way to verbalize his concerns, he will scream. The camp director, according to Mr. Croft, proposed that the bus continue while the staff spend a few stops trying to calm the boy. They were apparently willing to leave the bus if that did not work. They offered to take him off the bus if they couldn't calm him down, and I think a reasonable response would have been to say, "Okay," Mr. Croft said. The driver refused that and put them off the bus at that point. The whole camp had to get off the bus, and the bus driver refused to give them transfers so that they could catch the next bus, Mr. Croft said. A subsequent driver was more understanding, he added, and they completed their journey. Also from the Globe, This is a passage from Humans, Aliens, and Autism, an essay by University of Toronto philosopher Ian Hacking, who this week won Norway's $800,000 Holberg Prize for laying bare the social implications of science in the current issue of Daedalus, Journal of the American Academy of Arts and Sciences. Earth to humans, autism isn't from Mars. Neurotypical society has certainly excluded severely autistic people, consigning them at best to the role of village idiot or feral children, and at worst, consigning them to institutions that in retrospect seem absolutely horrific. Whether the metaphor has been used, the practice has been to exclude the severely autistic as if they were aliens. But now there are remarkable endeavors about that aim at integrating autistic individuals into a larger social world. It is now common practice to try to teach them how to infer the feelings and intentions of others from behavior, gestures, and tone of voice. Desperate parents of the severely autistic try everything. It's becoming pretty clear that no specific agenda is good for every autistic person, but there's good reason to hope that the social history of this ongoing progress is a promising tale of hard work. It's a ray of light in the rather gloomy history of humans. From The Spectator, an editorial, The Daily Gleaner, Fredericton, Changing Minds. We've probably all been depressed at one time, whether for a day or even for years. Perhaps we have a family member who suffers, or we know someone who's mentally ill. In fact, 20% of Canadians will personally experience a mental illness during their lifetime. And yet somehow we as a society fail to give the issue the compassionate attention, support, and understanding it deserves. Is it because it can manifest itself in embarrassing ways? Is it because it is less visible than a broken leg or a surgical incision? Is it because it affects the brain, the very core of our being, as opposed to the respiratory or the digestive system? It's a puzzle, that's for sure, but it doesn't make those suffering from it any less sick or their needs any less urgent or relevant. Brian Duplessis, executive director of Fredericton Homeless Shelters, estimates that 60% of the clientele there suffers from mental illness. They see schizophrenia, bipolar disease, depression, or a combination, and in varying degrees of severity. Medication is a huge help that can allow many to live what we would call normal lives, but often those suffering become clients because they've gone off their medication. The challenge is to stay on their meds, he said. They're not bad people. They're people with an illness. It's time we treated this illness as a legitimate illness, not a thing to be whispered about. And from the National Post, Wednesday, September 2nd, no remorse. Calgary woman gets 30 days after attempted pie in the face. An attempt to strike Alberta Premier Ed Stelmach with a cream pie at a Calgary Stampede breakfast 2 years ago has led to a 30-day jail sentence for a Calgary woman. In handing down the sentence on Monday, the judge noted Lily Fan was unrepentant. She expresses no remorse, offers no apology, Judge William Cummings said. Outside of court, Fan, 32, said had she actually managed to get pie filling on Mr. Stelmach, the damage would have amounted to no more than injured pride in a dry cleaning bill. The judge is right. I'm not remorseful, she told reporters. Fan said she tried to pie the premier to draw attention to what she called his government's shoddy environmental record and its lack of action on poverty and homelessness. Certainly from The Star, via The Spectator, doctors under scrutiny over duty of care to unborn. Teresa Boyle, health reporter. Does an obstetrician have a duty of care to an unborn child? Guelph Hospital, citing a 2008 court decision that found a doctor had no such obligation in the case of a girl born with birth defects because of an acne drug prescribed to her mother, says no. But the family of another child says yes. The issue is being argued in a London, Ontario courtroom. The Liebig family of Rockwood, just outside Guelph, has brought in a motion before the courts on behalf of their 8-year-old son, Kevin, born with hypoxic ischemic encephalopathy, or brain damage caused by oxygen deprivation. He's since been diagnosed with cerebral palsy, the result, his family says, of negligence on the part of 3 obstetricians and 4 obstetrical nurses at the birthing unit of Guelph General Hospital. The Liebigs claim that the mother, Susan, was given too much of the drug oxytocin to speed up labor and then not adequately monitored. The family's lawyer, Barbara Leggett, says the Liebigs were recently thrown a curveball by the defendants who are claiming to have no duty towards an unborn child. I think that's a jaw-dropping proposition, And I bet you that most obstetricians wouldn't agree, Leggett says. Unemployment soars in Hamilton. Spectator, Wednesday, August 26, Steve Arnold. New figures from Statistics Canada show the number of people getting employment insurance benefits in the Hamilton-Grimsby-Burlington area soared almost 130% between June 2008 and the same month this year. Under current rules, only about half of unemployed Canadians qualify for EI benefits. Don Fraser, president of the Hamilton and District Labour Council, said with defeated workers who've stopped looking for a job and part-time employees who'd rather be working full-time, I'd strongly suggest the number of unemployed people in Hamilton is over 30,000. Another troubling fear for labour leaders is the impact those soaring numbers of EI recipients could have on municipal welfare rules when benefits run out. Said Andrew Jackson, economist for the Canadian Labour Congress, people aren't exhausting their benefits in large numbers yet, but we're going to start seeing that in the fall. The economy has to be growing at 2 or 3% before employers start hiring again, Jackson said. I think we're going to have a pretty grim winter. That level of growth isn't likely this year or next, added CIBC World Markets chief economist Avery Shenfeld. While the recession may technically be over, we don't expect growth to average above the non-inflationary potential until 2011. And now Omar and the Howlers, a break. Dangerous Man.
Baby, keep your big mouth shut. Don't say nothing cause you've run out of love. You made me evil telling all of your lies. Pushed too far, I commit a crime. Don't you have a devil, who am I fool? I learned you something in genius school. Jump back, baby, while you still can. I'm warning you, baby, I'm a dangerous man. Better watch out, better show no behavior. Don't wanna start to make me rant and rave. Can't get the monkey one more time. You're gonna draw back, start to scream and cry. Don't you tamper with my temper, fool with my cool. I learned you something they didn't teach you to school. Jump back, baby, while you still can. I'm warning you, baby, I'm a dangerous man. Big mouth shut. Don't say nothing for you run out of luck. You made me evil telling all of your lies. Push me too far, I commit a crime. Don't you hammer with my camera, fool with my gun. I learned you something they didn't teach you school. Jump back, baby, while you still can. I'm warning you, baby, I'm a dangerous man.
Spectator, Monday, August 31st, Ignatius supports Mac Isotopes, promises funding for nuclear reactor if the Liberals were in power. McMaster University will get all the money it needs to solve Canada's medical isotope crisis as long as Michael Ignatieff gets to be the next Prime Minister. The opposition Liberal leader made his promises over the weekend after touring Mac's nuclear reactor and flogging the Harper government for letting the crisis develop. Canada has had leadership in this field for 60 years. It's regrettable to say the least that Mr. Harper and the Conservatives have had two shutdowns to supplies of nuclear isotopes on their watch, he said. I don't want to drag McMaster into political bacon, but Mac came to the government a very long time ago and after the first shutdown and said, how can we help? They've had no reply, Ignatieff said. A modest pro bono proposal. Mike Foderick, the spec. Literally hundreds of criminal defense lawyers have en masse begun refusing to accept new legal aid cases for several serious offenses. They argue that the current legal aid tariff is antiquated and must be updated. In an adversarial legal system like ours, the prospects for justice in criminal cases against poor defendants are jeopardized as a result. This debate has highlighted the cynicism and pessimism about current legal aid regime that the next generation of Ontario lawyers does not wholly share and does not want to inherit. Citizens and organizations of limited means should have access to the best legal representation on occasion, but the current system, even with an increase, ensures that veteran lawyers who command high hourly rates will never work for the paltry tariff amount. Introducing modest mandatory minimums for pro bono hours would be a dramatic change. Some state and provincial governments have experimented with mandatory disclosure of pro bono work. By requiring small mandatory minimums, Ontario would be at the leading edge of recognizing lawyers' commitment, not just to themselves or their firm, but the access to and facilitation of justice as a whole. Hamilton needs supportive housing. Spectator Fran Chesney. Sadly, housing for people with disabilities or chronic diseases needs more attention. Supportive housing provides people with some ongoing financial support to make rent affordable and staff on-site or on an on-call basis that provide support, such as assistance with bathing, toileting, dressing, meal preparation, and house cleaning that allow people to live independently. There's an acute shortage of housing with supports in Hamilton. March of Dimes, a provincial attendant care provider, indicates that their waiting list in Hamilton has 90 applicants that have been waiting upwards of 10 years for service. The Minister of Municipal Affairs and Housing will be in Hamilton on September 10th, 6:30 to 9:30 p.m. For more information or to attend the consultation session, visit the ministry's website at mah.gov.on.ca. The government should, number one, align housing strategies with the Accessibility for Ontarians with Disabilities Act. This can be accomplished by incorporating universal barrier-free design conditions into all provincially funded affordable housing in the future. Two, increase rent supplement programs for people with disabilities to help reduce the number of people waiting for accessible social housing by helping people find suitable rental housing in the private market. Number three, increase funding available for home modifications or retrofits inclusive of the rental market to make them more accessible. And last, encourage the Government of Ontario to address the urgent need for additional housing with supports and to include lengthy wait times for attendance services and supportive housing on the provincial waitlist strategy. Report on paramedic delay postponed. Brody Finlan in the Globe. Family and friends of a man who died in June of a heart attack while outside Toronto paramedics waited won't know the results of a provincial investigation for another month. 59-year-old James Hurst died late June 25th in the hallway of his Alexander Street building after waiting for more than half an hour for an ambulance and despite the frantic efforts of three bystanders who performed CPR on him. An IntelliGuard security guard and her dispatch office made at least two calls to Toronto EMS. Bruce Farr, chief of Toronto Emergency Medical Services, asked the province to investigate the call in mid-July. He had earlier told reporters that paramedics were on the scene within 9 minutes of receiving an initial non-emergency 911 call, but stayed outside because they feared for their health and safety. He didn't elaborate. Mr. McLeod said the excuse doesn't wash. He noted that the building is in a safe part of town. A security guard was with Mr. Hurst most of the time, and she had spoken twice to Toronto EMS dispatchers. In terms of the quality of dispatching information that EMS gets, it doesn't get any better than that, he said. Those paramedics sat in the truck down the street until the guy was cold. That's just bacon. Manuel Rodriguez, who performed CPR on Mr. Hurst and went public with his concerns about the delay, said he has yet to be interviewed by anyone. It's unbelievable, he said. Stranded autistic man can return to Canada. A young autistic Canadian man who's been stranded in Kenya for 3 years may soon be headed home. Lawyer Jean Lash, who is representing Mohammed's mother, Anab Issa, says the case has been frustrating, especially since friends and family of Mohammed have given Passport Canada no less than 6 affidavits attesting to his identity. It could also be a month or more before Mohammed returns to Canada because his low-income mother insists on going to Kenya to retrieve him and is raising the money needed for the flights on her own. Mohammed, an autistic 25-year-old Somali-Canadian, was taken to Somalia 5 years ago by his mother when doctors recommended he be near extended family. But when Issa tried to bring him back to Canada through Kenya 3 years ago, she was told her son didn't look like his passport photo. And now, very briefly, some of the good news. Unique Heart Procedure helps. Amazing Grace. Peterborough. An 11-year-old girl from Peterborough underwent a unique heart procedure in Edmonton. Grace Wood was to have a pulmonary valve replaced in what's believed to be the first operation of its kind for a child in North America. Doctors in Edmonton said the heart procedure was successful. However, the surgery was not without drama. A balloon used to expand her vein burst, and doctors then had to retrieve it and try again. Grace, nicknamed Amazing Grace because she wasn't expected to live past the age of 2, has a condition known as DeGeorge syndrome and has endured 3 open-heart surgeries among at least 35 procedures. If her recovery goes well, the youngster should be back in class in September. My understanding is that her parents, however, paid for their accommodation and travel to Edmonton to get this procedure done. That was from The Spectator. This from The Globe. Transit to remain free for visually impaired in Halifax. Halifax Regional Council has decided that Metro Transit will keep providing free rides to blind and partly sighted passengers. Regional Council's move to continue its transit pass program nullified a controversial recommendation from municipal staff to discontinue the practice. Staff had proposed the 3 bus passes offered to 500 blind and visually impaired people be yanked September 30th. Front page news in The Spectator, Monday, August 24th, Crazy Daisy's Pedal Power. This story goes on for 2 pages. If you can access it at the library, please do, because I can't give you much of it. It's ironic that flowers have saved Sarah Moir's life, says Meredith McLeod of The Spectator. Struggling with mental illness since adolescence, Moir hit the lowest point of her life at 27. It was a major turning point, she says, with tears sliding down her cheeks. I had become every negative stereotype. If I wanted to live, I had to learn how to. No one in my life wanted to be around me anymore. I didn't want to be around me anymore. She pushed for help, got a diagnosis for her illness, and plunged herself into studying floral design and opening her own business. Almost exactly a year ago, Moir, 34, launched Crazy Daisy. She already provides the arrangements for the Mayor's Luncheon series in Hamilton and has a growing roster of corporate clients. She's also done the floral catering for events at Mohawk College and a few weddings. Her biggest job so far will be providing the flowers for a gala event marking Mental Illness Awareness Week in Ottawa in October. While her target is the corporate and nonprofit world, Moir is set up to take small and one-time orders for anniversaries, funerals, and birthdays too. While she has taken some criticism for the name of her business, especially from mental health professionals who say it's stigmatizing, Moir says she's embracing the label of crazy and turning the stigma on its head. She hopes to open some eyes, change some minds, and ultimately be an inspiration. Quote, "It would be as selfish of me not to go full force. I've been given a terrific opportunity. I have to give this my all. Even if Crazy Daisy stays local, the next social enterprise might change the world." And again, from The Spectator, an Associated Press story by Apichart Weerabong, Lampang, Thailand. Motola, an elephant who lost a foot and part of her leg when she stepped on a landmine 10 years ago, happily if tentatively stepped out after being fitted with an artificial limb. In her first stroll with the permanent prosthesis, the 48-year-old female walked out of her enclosure for about 10 minutes, grabbed some dust with her trunk, and jubilantly sprayed it in the air. It's gone very well. She's walked around twice, said Sarita Selwala, Secretary General of the Friends of the Asian Elephant, a private group. She has not put her whole weight on it yet, but she's okay. Sarita's group established the Elephant Hospital in northern Thailand, where Motola was being treated in 1993. The world's first such facility, the hospital has treated thousands of elephants for ailments ranging from eye infections to gunshot wounds. Landmine injuries are only one of many problems facing the domesticated giant, whose numbers have dropped from 13,400 in 1950 to today's estimated 2,500. The number of wild elephants has also dropped dramatically. Traditionally, the truck, taxi, and logging worker of Thailand, the elephant's role has been eroded due to modernization. One saving grace has been tourism, which employs many elephants for trekking and other activities. On that note, Disrespect wraps up the news review. Come back, we'll have more for you next week. Now to take us out, Room Full of Blues, Boogie Woogie Girl.
Well, hello, it's you, the dungarees, red jacket shirt. If you please, my boogie woogie, boogie woogie, boogie woogie country girl. Well, you dig what I mean, my boogie woogie country girl. Well, you dig that music, with a beat and rock and roll. It's the me, my boogie woogie, boogie woogie, boogie woogie country girl. I dig what I mean, my boogie woogie country girl. Now every Saturday night you like to come downtown and play the jukebox, let it hang down. My boogie woogie, boogie woogie, boogie woogie country girl. I dig what I mean, my boogie woogie country girl.
You can now listen to the show wherever you're near the internet. Disrespect is streamed live at http://cfmu.msumcmaster.ca. You can email us at dialogue, D-I-A-L-O-G-U-E, at radio.fm. Disrespect is archived at www.radioforall.net. That's the number 4, not the word, radioforall.net. You can find the shows under its name, Disrespect. Tune in at Showtime, Thursdays at noon, 93.3 FM, CFMU, to see if something more topical hasn't displaced the show that we planned. Disrespect is digitally edited from live telephone and studio interviews.